went to some awful sci-fi flick.
Yeah.
Oh, it was great.
It was awful.
I was a teenage Martian lesbo or something. You know, one of those flicks where the only time you watch the screen is if there's someone naked or someone getting killed or both.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Junk Food Dinner, episode 18. This week we travel to the mountains and watch a group of yuppies get kicked off one by one in the ski-themed straight-to-video slasher film, Ice, from 1988. Then it's the end of the world as we know it, and we feel fine when we watch the 1983 Italian post-apocalyptic action flick, 2019, After the Fall of New York. And finally, we take a look at the so-bad-it's-good low-budget romantic thriller that sweeping the nation, 2008's Birdemic, Shock and Terror.
But when I got back, my tits were soggy from the rain.
Welcome to Junk Food Dinner, episode 18. This is the podcast where each week we scour the internet, video stores, and cable television, looking for the most outrageous and interesting cult films. We're not professional film journalists or critics by any means. We are simply three geeks from Ohio with entirely too much time on our hands. I'm Kevin Moss. I'm joined by my co-hosts Mark Fredo and Parker Bowman. Every week we'll each bring a cult favorite to the table and recall our personal experience with the film. We'll discuss its merits and argue why or why we did not enjoy it. This week, it's no stars, no budgets, and big dreams as we explore three low-budget cheese fests. First is the ski-themed slasher Iced from 1988. Then we have the Italian post-apocalyptic action flick 2019, After the Fall of New York from 1983. And finally, we have the so-bad-it's-good romantic thriller that's sweeping the nation, Birdemic, Shock and Terror from 2008. But first, gentlemen, how are you doing this week?
Good.
Good. You guys do anything? Good. You guys do anything fun this week?
I went to the mountains the other day, so that was pretty fun.
Oh, yeah. What mountains?
It's the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And I went out to the Sequoia National Forest, which is where the huge skyscraper-like trees live, and they are crazy. Like, people, ever since I got out here, people have been like, have you gone to the trees yet? Have you gone to these trees yet? And I was like, what? There's some trees. Who cares? You know, I've seen trees before in my day. But I have not seen trees before in my day. These trees are insanely huge. Like, they're awesome in the literal sense of the word.
Yeah.
They put you in awe. They're wild.
Yeah, I've been out to those as well, and they really are awesome. You know, when you can stand with a bunch of your friends inside of a tree, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I felt like David the Gnome.
Nice.
Yeah, I didn't do anything nearly that exciting. Actually, I don't think I did anything at all. I packed a lot this week, which pretty much involved me, like, looking at all of my books instead of packing them.
Right. That'll happen. So,
yeah. Reading a bunch of hamburger jokes.
Nice. You have 101 hamburger jokes?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a classic. I had that as a kid as well. That's some classic literature.
Yeah, we'll trade punchlines here after the show.
All right, sounds good. Yeah, I saw a couple good musical performances. I saw Bob Log III perform on Friday, and that was a good time. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's like a one-man band kind of thing. He plays guitar wearing a motorcycle helmet with a phone attached to it that he sings through, and then like plays drums with his feet and plays guitar. It's pretty awesome. And then I saw, yes, last night I went and saw the New York hipster favorites, Yola Tango, which was all right. It was kind of boring, but it was still a good show.
I love Yola Tango. Were they at the Southgate House?
Yeah, and it was a good show, but I mean, like I said, it started off real slow, and I didn't recognize a lot of the songs, so it was a little boring for the most part, but it was still a good show.
Cool.
Didn't you go see Gucci Mane?
I did. That was last Saturday.
Yeah, how was that?
It was fun.
Yeah. Was it?
There were about 40 openers.
Yeah.
And none of them were any good. Actually, some of them were rapping over Gucci Mane beats at the Gucci Mane show, which I wouldn't have done, but you know, but it was a good time.
What was the audience pretty, like? Was it mostly white kids or was it
No, I was in the minority. One guy asked if I was Zach Galifianakis and I told him I was. Yeah, I think a lot of people might have thought I was a cop. They kept, like, getting out of my way because I was trying to go up front, you know, because it was a show and I was trying to get up front. But I'm sure I looked pretty square. Yeah. But it was fun. I had a good time.
That's cool. All right, well, let's get into the nerd news segment of the show. Every week, I like to keep you abreast of things going on in the world of movies and stuff that nerds would be interested in. The first one I saw was that Len Wiseman, who did like Underworld, those Underworld movies, and the Live Free or Die Hard, he is going to be doing a remake of Total Recall. So you can mark Total Recall up on the... what are you eating there, Mark? You got some jelly beans?
Oh, it's gumballs. I turned my microphone off. I was like, oh, this will work.
Did you bring enough for all of us?
Yeah.
All right.
You guys can have all the orange ones.
Okay. But yeah, we got Len Wiseman, the guy that did Underworld and Live Free or Die Hard. He's doing a Total Recall remake, so you can add that to the list of Arnold Schwarzenegger movies that are being remade. I don't know. I really like the original Total Recall, so it'll be interesting to see how they go with this one. But, you know, I'm not holding out a lot of hope, as we usually say with a lot of these remakes.
I'm going to say this seems entirely unnecessary.
Yeah.
Yeah, I yelled at somebody on Facebook. Like, I'm usually not into remakes. Like, if somebody remakes an obscure horror movie, like, I'll give them a little slack, because, I mean, how many people have seen, Black Christmas or whatever? But, you know, when you remake a movie that's big and readily available for people, it seems very much more superfluous than normal. But yeah, I yelled at somebody on Facebook the other day because Total Recall is based on a book, and it's not technically a remake if you're remaking something that's based on a book. You're just doing another version.
And yeah, so that's true to an extent.
Yeah, I'm a stickler for that. Like, I got all up in these people's faces. I was typing in all caps. It's a book! And so on and so forth.
But, that sounds serious.
Well, that's from that, this is saddening, because I really, really like that movie.
Well, yeah, since you mentioned that, it'll be interesting to see if they do this remake more as a remake of the original novel, or if they will be remaking the Arnold Schwarzenegger Total Recall movie with the same elements that were in the movie as opposed to those that were in the book. But
yeah, after I yelled at those people, I realized that they probably will go farther away from the book with the remake.
Yeah.
So I felt bad afterwards, but I don't know. I'm sure that's how remakes of the books will go in the future. They'll just burn all the books that movies came from, just to avoid this conversation.
Right.
I would think.
Well, I was just gonna say, I hope that they they don't make the three boob lady all CGI.
Yeah,
that would really detract from the film, I think.
Right. Yeah, you
I hope that in the remake they top the original by giving her four boobs.
Right, all CGI. The next story that I had, it looks like Disney finally sold Miramax. It looks like the Walt Disney Company that owned Miramax for a long time, that released a lot of cool pictures in the 90s, like Clerks and Pulp Fiction, actually sold it to a construction company led by a guy named Rob Tudor. The group bought the company for $660 million, and it'll be interesting to see what this means for the future of a lot of those movies on home video, if they'll change their distributing practices or anything, and how they'll proceed with releasing new movies under the Miramax label, if anything will change in the company, or if it'll be business as usual and we can expect some more good movies in the future. But yeah, I thought that was an interesting kind of business note. I don't know if maybe even Disney was holding Miramax back, and now that they're under kind of a more independent company, that they'll be able to release more stuff that they weren't able to when they were under the Disney stranglehold. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
I wonder who will employ Kevin Smith now.
Right.
I'm actually kind of surprised it took them that long to sell Miramax.
Yeah.
But I guess, it's a recession.
It looks like Bob and Harvey Weinstein, who originally started the Miramax company, were trying to get the company back, but were outbid by this, this construction guy, Rob Tudor, who bought it for $660 million. So it sucks that, the Weinstein brothers couldn't get it back, but, it'll be interesting to see what this construction dude does with it.
Agreed.
I bet there's going to be a lot of remakes of old Miramax movies, but with construction guys in the role.
Yeah. Another story I had, and this is one that, Parker, you actually had posted something on the blog about, but it looks like Elvira is returning to television, which should be pretty awesome. Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Looks like she'll be coming back to TV in September, and she'll be doing the kind of basically the same thing she did in the 80s, where she'll host horror movies and kind of do them in a campy way. And it's exciting news for me because it's going to be on this network, which is a non-cable channel that's like a subsidiary of Fox, and I get it on broadcast network TV, so it'll be cool not to have to have cable to see Elvira again.
Yeah, I hope that when I move that someone I'm living with has a digital converter box. So and that we get this. Because I when I got rid of cable, I haven't had one. So I've just been, you know, using my watch instantly on the TV, so I haven't seen actual TV in quite some time. And I don't necessarily miss it, but I know that this is a pretty awesome network. I used to have it, and there was always something good on there, so.
Yeah, they're a subsidiary of MGM, and they play a lot of their stuff, but they do play a lot of cult and horror stuff, which is really cool. And so I'm glad to see that they're bringing back Elvira, even though she's now, you know, 60 years old, which is, you know, kind of a little up there to be doing the whole sexy horror host thing. But, you know, I think she can still kind of pull it off. But I always liked her stuff in the 80s, and I think it'll be cool to have her back on TV. And if we're lucky, you know, maybe this will bring back Joe Bob Briggs or something as well.
Yeah, that'd be
awesome.
That would
be fantastic.
So
that would be a new golden age.
Right. And in a modern update, I guess she's going to be tweeting puns during the movie, and they'll pop up on the screen, pop-up video style. So, I don't know how I feel about that.
Is that true?
That is true.
I did love pop-up video.
Yeah, well, that sounds fun, because it'll be like people making fun of the movie, but it'll be tweets popping up and stuff, I would assume.
Yeah.
Occasionally use that Twitter that we have.
Right.
Yeah.
So, another story that we talked about, and we've touched on this a lot, and I promise this will probably be the last time we talk about it, but we talked about how Guillermo del Toro dropped off of The Hobbit, and you know, it seems like he's been keeping busy despite not being working on The Hobbit. We talked about how he's going to be doing a reboot of Disney's The Haunted Mansion, but it also looks like him and James Cameron are actually going to team up for a movie called Mountain of Madness. It's actually going to be directed by Guillermo del Toro and produced by James Cameron. And it's going to be a 3D film for Universal Pictures. And, yeah, it looks like it could be pretty cool.
Yeah, I've been pretty excited. I mean, this has been something he's been talking about for a long time, and he bought the rights a long time ago. And I think he was held up because he wanted to shoot on location, you know, in the Arctic and stuff, and everybody was not that into it. But, yeah, it's, you know, H.P. Lovecraft, Cthulhu, Elder Gods type stuff, and I think it's going to be totally awesome.
Sweet. Yeah, I don't know if this is just getting underway now. It looks like it's in its very early development stages, so it'll probably be a long time before we see anything come of that, but, you know, hopefully it'll live up to the expectations.
Well, as long as it lives up to mine.
Right. the next piece of nerd news that I had is it looks like J.J. Abrams and Bad Robot Productions are going to make Boilerplate into a live-action movie. I don't know if you're familiar with the graphic novel Boilerplate, but it's about a robot in the first robot in the Victorian century. I've actually never read it, but it takes place in 1893, and it's about a robot in olden times. So I guess it's you know, got a lot of fans for the graphic novel. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out.
Oh, it's steampunk, like the Time Changer.
Right, exactly. Seems like there's a lot of steampunk going on these days.
Yeah.
And the last piece of nerd news I had, and Mark, you saw Human Centipede, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, yeah.
I said that a little too enthusiastically.
Well, yeah, I've been wanting to see it. Unfortunately, it didn't come to any theaters near me, but I'm excited to read that it will be coming to DVD and Blu-ray on October 5th, so I will get my Netflix queue prepared for that, because I really did want to see that. I've heard nothing. I mean, but most people just say you just got to see it just for the weirdness of it. And anytime I hear reviews of that, it's even if it's bad, I kind of have to see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth watching, but it wasn't the I've seen more fucked up shit than that. So,
really?
I don't know. But yeah, it's definitely gross, and I would hate to be the middle link.
Right.
Front is really the sweet spot.
Yeah, you can eat real food.
Yeah, eat real food.
Not poop.
No shit in your mouth.
Right. Well, yeah, so keep your eyes open for that when it hits DVD.
Yeah, you're going to have to cop that Blu-ray. See it in HD.
That's right. See the shit-eating in high def. All right, well, let's get to some cool stuff on DVD this week. Every week we like to tell you about some of the interesting titles that are going to be hitting the shelves, and you can stick at the top of your Netflix queue or send your little brother out on the torrents to download and burn for you or however you acquire your movies these days. The first one coming out, probably the biggest release this week, is Kick-Ass from earlier this year, starring Nicolas Cage and Mark Strong, directed by Matthew Vaughn. Did you guys see this when it was in the theaters?
I did.
Nah, I missed it, sadly.
Yeah, I really wanted to see it, and I just didn't get around to actually going to the theater and checking it out. But, Mark, what did you think of this?
I liked it. It was less McLovin than I thought it was going to be, so that was good.
Yeah.
I liked it. I thought it was fun and stylized, and yeah, it was just a fun movie. So.
Yeah, so that comes out on DVD and Blu-ray this week, so if you're interested, check that out. Next one is A Prophet or Un Prophet from 2009. Now, this is kind of a gritty French movie that takes place in prison about a 19-year-old kid that is locked up in prison. He speaks French and Arabic, and instead of congregating with the Muslim inmates, he keeps to himself, providing himself to be a perfect target for a mob boss who makes him a godfather-like offer he can't refuse to kill the head Arab guy in the prison. So I've heard nothing but really good things. It's in French. This played at some of the art house theaters and stuff around here, but I've heard it's really intense, like really gripping, gritty prison movie. And it's actually like pretty critically acclaimed, not really a cult film by any means, but super long. It's like 149 minutes, but I heard it goes by really fast. It's very action-packed. So I've heard nothing but good things, so I really wanted to check this out.
That sounds kind of awesome. Yeah, I hadn't heard anything about that, but that's one I'll have to put in the queue.
Yeah, a lot of critics and stuff had it out there on their top 10 list for the best of last year, so it's finally making its home video release here in the United States this week. It's been out for a while overseas, but yeah, it's finally making its home video debut here. So yeah, if you get a chance, check that out. The next one I had was Escape from New York is coming out on a Blu-ray high-def transfer with a lot of new special features. Now, this is one of my favorite movies of all time, my one of two Kurt Russell movies that I consider like must owns, that and The Thing, and yeah, this is finally getting the high def treatment, and I might have to upgrade, even though I own it already on VHS and DVD. I might have to make a third purchase of Escape from New York just because it's so badass. You guys like this movie at all?
I'm gonna hold out for
I've never seen it.
Escape from LA on Blu-ray.
Oh, that's already out actually. Oh, you've never seen Escape from New York, Parker?
No, I'm a total Melvin. I've seen the second one. And I actually rented Escape from New York a few weeks ago, but I didn't get around to watching it because I rented like 10 movies or something. But well, I feel awful.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the movies we're talking about this week, 2019, After the Fall of New York, I think actually shares a lot of parallels and probably might have been slightly ripping off Escape from New York in a lot of aspects. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. Also this week, we've got a slew of new titles from the Roger Corman Cult Classics Collection hitting the shelves. The first one we have is a double feature of Death Sport and Battle Truck, two movies on one DVD. And those look pretty interesting. I think both of those are making their digital debut. They hadn't been released before other than on VHS. You know, like all Roger Corman features, they look like, good, low-budget mayhem. And I think both of these take place in futuristic worlds, so this might be two to check out. Two of his more well-known movies are actually making their way on DVD and Blu-ray this week as well. We've got Humanoids from the Deep from 1980 and Piranha from 1979, directed by Joe Dante, who later went on to do Gremlins and a lot of stuff. But it's interesting because actually the timing of this Piranha DVD Blu-ray kind of coincides with they just released a new Red Band trailer for the Piranha 3D remake that'll be hitting theaters soon. But yeah, have you guys seen anything on that?
The Piranha 3D?
Yeah.
Oh, I've seen a lot of stuff on that. I'm eagerly awaiting this movie.
Yeah. I think Joe Dante is going to be here at the Wexner Center, and it might be after I'm gone, but you should definitely come up for it.
Yeah, maybe I can get him to sign my Blu-ray of Piranha. Humanoids from the Deep is another one that I've been wanting to see for a while. It was on it was on DVD for a while. It went out of print, and ever since then, it's like $60 on eBay to get. So now that it's kind of got a more wide release, I'll be interesting to check that out because it's kind of like an homage to 1950s monster movies. So hopefully it's not like Slithus, but better.
Yeah, agreed. I was just going to ask if they just smear blood all over people.
Yeah, I don't know. Let's hope not. The next one that I saw was a movie called Spike. It's a horror movie from this year. It's after skidding off the road in the dead of night, four friends find themselves lost in the forest, tangled in a twisted love story. They are picked off one by one by a bizarre beast that, and then it becomes clear that no one will make it out alive. And I saw the trailer for this, and the monster in this movie looks like a half-human, half-porcupine-looking thing, and it looks so bad that it might actually be worth watching. So, Spike, check that out.
I thought it was going to be about volleyball, but
no,
it's way better.
Yeah.
I was hoping that it would be about the Buffy character. I'm real excited.
No, unfortunately not. Next one coming out on DVD this week is The Dead Pit from 1989. Now, this one's making its DVD debut. This is actually a zombie movie, like I said, from 1989, about a mad doctor named Dr. Ramsey, who's been locked in an asylum for the past 20 years after having performed gruesome experiments on his patients and then tossing their corpses into a pit. Now the new asylum patient with the psychic abilities unwittingly gives Ramsey the power to awaken from his long slumber, resurrecting his former victims from the dead, and they form an unstoppable army to avenge his captors. So, I don't know, a lost 1989 zombie movie. Sounds fairly interesting. Might be worth checking out.
Yeah, I've never seen that, so.
Yeah, I had never even heard of it, so.
Yeah, I mean, there's no shortage of zombie stuff at the moment, so maybe something, you know, some old blood might not be the worst thing.
Right.
Yeah, I never saw this, but I remember seeing the VHS cover all the time.
Really?
It's just some zombie coming up out of the ground.
Yeah.
But it looked pretty cool. I should have seen it when I was little, I guess.
Well, now's your chance.
Yes! We're getting second chances.
Right. And then the last two DVDs I have are actually two goofball comedies from the 80s that are making their DVD debut this week. The first one is All Nighter from 1987. One night before graduating from college, straight-laced valedictorian Molly searches for someone special to bed, while Val questions her current relationship, and Gina, played by Joan Cusack, tries to record a very precious moment on her video camera. So yeah, it's a beach party comedy. It also stars John Turklesley as a hunky surfer dude. He was also in Chopping Mall, so I don't know, that sounds like it could be interesting. And then the other one is we have Going Berserk from 1983. This stars John Candy, John Flaherty, and Eugene Levy, who are all from Second City, and it's a 1983 comedy that spoofs kung fu movies, Leave It to Beaver, and The Manchurian Candidate, and it's supposed to be ridiculous. So if you have a taste for, you know, 80s goofy nonsense,
yeah, that's check probably that out. Pretty funny. I like all those dudes. Kevin Merriman has ruined Joe Flaherty for me a little bit by showing me this instructional video he did called How to Make Funny Videos.
Yeah,
where he's like doing it as Count Floyd, and it's pretty much how to fake America's Funniest Home Video type clips. It's really, really awful. So if you get a chance, check that out.
What's the name of the video?
How to Make Funny Videos.
I will look for that.
Yeah, so if you like Joe Flaherty, you won't anymore.
All right. I'll take your word for it. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, and we are going to come back, and Mark is going to tell us about the 1988 slasher movie Iced, so stick around. Gucci Mane LaFleur, yeah, where your ice at? Where your chain and your wings at? Where your bling at? I'm icy, I'm icy.
Some old friends of ours.
They're not coming?
No, they're not coming. Eddie's my soon-to-be ex-boyfriend, and Jeff's dead!
Jeff was a friend of ours who died in an accident. Jeff Stinson.
What? Did you know him?
No, but I thought he was coming with you. I mean, his name was on the list.
What list?
The list of people in your party.
What are you talking about?
I sent Jeff Stinson an invitation and he accepted.
Did you actually speak to him?
Hey, man. Where the hell did you get our names from anyways?
Hey, cool it.
Damn it!
we buy mailing lists.
Listen, we all checked in at the same hotel that weekend, right? We checked in at the same time. Do you buy these lists from resort hotels?
That's right, we do. And no, I didn't speak with him. I only talked to you. The actual mailings were handled by our office.
We didn't realize Jeff's name would be on the list.
He's dead. You invited a dead man.
And he accepted.
I don't understand this.
Jesus!
Welcome back to Junk Food Dinner, episode 18. We're going to take a look at 1988's slasher ski movie, Iced. In this film, a group of friends set out for what's supposed to be a relaxing ski weekend that ends in tragedy when one of them plummets to his death after being led on by this total prick tease. it really screws up everybody's weekend, but it doesn't stop them from reuniting 4 years later to check out a brand new ski lodge, because skiing is still at the height of its popularity. So they arrive at the ski lodge and everything's great. It's really nice. It's nice to see everyone again, but something is amiss as one of the characters finds a news clipping about the tragic death of their friend in his drawer. And everyone suspects that everyone else is playing a trick on them, but they soon discover it's not, as someone starts killing them off one by one. Is it their dead friend, Jeff? Is it their missing friend who hasn't shown up yet because he's already dead? No, it's someone else entirely. But this is a pretty standard issue, slasher movie. But what really makes it nice is that it's all about skiing. And nothing could be more timely than a movie about skiing. It seems like at any given time, someone's talking about skiing. And someone actually says, he compromised my integrity as a skier and all this stuff. So I just thought it was a really funny time capsule and kind of late addition to the slasher movie. what did you guys think of Iced?
So this is a direct-to-video movie from 1988, and it kind of has that direct-to-video feel to it. The production quality and the acting is what you'd expect from a direct-to-video movie from 1988. Yeah, like you said, it is kind of a late entry into the slasher film. It came out in 1988 after the slasher genre had kind of petered out. And I guess they thought this was kind of a unique take on the slasher genre, putting it in the snow on the ski slopes and basing it around a bunch of yuppies that like to ski. So I don't know. It was okay. It was kind of boring. It didn't really pick up until about the last half hour when the actual killing started. But up until then, it was kind of boring.
Yeah, it's not the most exciting. But you get a couple early kills, and then it's just a bunch of rich white people sitting around talking about skiing and like occasionally doing coke and trying to fuck each other, and then everybody gets killed. So that's nice, but yeah. Everything of it, there really is. And when I watched this again, for the show, I was like, I don't remember it being so goddamn boring, but it is. It's pretty slow up until you get all the fun ski related kills.
Yeah, I really like the guy by the name of Carl in this movie. He's kind of like their goofy friend with that terrible ponytail, and he's wearing the Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah.
But yeah, as soon as I saw him in that Hawaiian shirt, I immediately looked at my roommate and said, this guy is breaking out cocaine at some point in this movie. And sure enough, no more than 15 minutes later, he was cutting up lines naked in the bathtub.
Yeah.
But I was really hoping there was some good, like, skiing cocaine puns, but, you know, like...
There was one. He threw a bunch of snow all over his face, which I think was...
Yeah.
But, yeah. A girl fillets a carrot. Another girl has a really awesome t-shirt that says Rockadiles.
Yeah.
Which I liked a lot. The original name of this movie was Blizzard of Blood, which I like a lot more.
Yeah, that's far better. Yeah.
That's way better. When I was on YouTube trying to find this movie, all I could find were Iced Earth videos. Just all these metal videos everywhere. I couldn't find the movie.
Yeah.
So Blizzard. But I guess if it was Blizzard of Blood, there probably would have been other metal videos.
Right? Yeah, that's true.
Parker, what did you think of this?
I thought it was good. It was good. Just because I'm disposed to liking slasher movies, but it's not good. Otherwise, this probably wouldn't be good at all for somebody who didn't enjoy watching rich teenagers get murdered. I guess these guys are a little bit older than teenagers, but so it was all right. It's kind of a third or fourth tier slasher movie. You know, like it's no Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Nightmare on Elm Street, and it's no Nightmare on Elm Street sequel, and it's no April Fool's Day. But underneath that, you got a pretty solid movie.
Yeah, it's everything you'd expect from like a ski themed slasher movie. Somebody gets stabbed in the neck with a ski pole. A woman gets stabbed in the eye with a icicle, and dude gets his legs snapped with bear traps out in the snow. So I mean, it's like everything that I thought would happen in this movie did, and so it kind of just hit all the notes. So I mean, it definitely delivered on what you thought, but like I said, it took about an hour to get into the actual killing, and everything up until then was just fucking annoying.
Yeah.
For about 5 minutes before the killing starts, there's a good scene where like everybody's at each other's throats, like, who's doing this? Where's our buddy? Is our friend really dead? It's your fault. You're the one who's doing this. And I thought that was interesting, but it only happened for about 5 minutes. Like, if they would have started that sooner and made it a slow build up to everybody being mad at each other and suspicious, it would have been cooler.
Yeah.
It seemed like they just threw it in. Like, oh, we need these guys to do something other than ski real quick.
Well, my favorite bit, and it comes towards the end, is when the last girl, the one that drove, I don't want to give it away, the killer to murder, is trapped up in an upstairs bedroom, and she has a pair of scissors, and it is like a shot-for-shot ripoff of the bathroom scene in The Shining, except that instead of having an axe, the killer comes through the door with a ski pole.
Yeah.
And she, you know, she stabs him in the hand and stuff, but I thought that was really funny.
Right. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I liked a little bit before that, the killer stabs one of the guys just in the shoulder, and then that guy is effectively down and out for the rest of the movie. Like, he's just on the floor moaning the rest of the movie after being stabbed in
the
shoulder.
That's probably what I'd do, though. I'm not above feigning death to escape real death.
Right.
Some people might say I'm a coward, but they're dead.
Now, despite this being a fairly low-budget, straight-to-video movie, there's actually a few faces in here that you might recognize. Deborah DeLiso, the girl that was the main girl, Trina, in this movie, I recognized her from a movie called Slumber Party Massacre, where she, in essence, played the same kind of character, getting stalked by, you know, some slasher. And then also, this movie has Lisa Loring, who was the original Wednesday Addams in The Addams Family, all grown up and getting naked in a hot tub. So that's pretty cool. If you always wanted to see Wednesday Addam naked, this movie. Well, first of all, you're a pervert.
Yeah, you're probably on a list or something.
But she's of full legal age in this movie, I assure you, and she doesn't look anything like her Wednesday Addam persona, but she does get naked in a hot tub. So yeah, this movie had a lot of nudity in it. I mean, I guess for a straight-to-video 80s slash, I guess that's kind of expected, but quite a bit of sex scenes and some nudity, so that at least perked things up when it got a little boring.
And all of those sex scenes made it onto YouTube somehow.
Right, shut up.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
You're blowing it for all the perverts.
But yeah, I mean, this movie isn't available on DVD, and rightfully so. you can check it out on VHS, or it is in its full glory on YouTube as we speak, but, you know, now that Parker spilled the beans, who knows how long that'll last.
Yeah. Sorry, I wanted to mention this. Getting back to Slumber Party Massacre.
Yeah.
The guy that plays Alex Bourne, who was one of the writers for this movie, or the writer for this movie, was also in Slumber Party Massacre as Neil.
Okay, so probably a lot of people.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this movie is fairly ridiculous on a lot of counts. I mean, there's a lot of really great 80s like yuppie fashion and hairstyles, which are fun to look at for a little while you wait for people to get murdered.
Yeah, while you're waiting for Wednesday Addams to take off her 80s fashions, you get to look at a lot of nice 80s fashions.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. If you and your rich white friends are up skiing, this might be a fun movie to bust out to warn against doing that kind of thing.
Right. Let me ask you this. Have either of you two ever been skiing?
Yes, mm-hmm. I was in ski club in 7th grade, so
oh, wow.
I think I know a little bit about skiing.
Look at you, Thurston Howell.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Peekaboo Street.
Right.
She the skier? Yeah. She did those chapstick commercials.
Parker, you ever been skiing?
Oh, yeah, I've never gone skiing.
Oh, so you can't relate to this movie at all.
Yeah, yeah. I can't. Well, I've never gone skiing, but I have watched the Aspen episode of South Park, like, a whole lot, so I kind of get it.
Right. Yeah, no, I've never been skiing either. It's always been something that's beyond me. So, I couldn't enjoy the skiing elements of this movie either. Now, let me ask you this. Have either of you two ever iced a bro?
No, I don't know what that is.
Oh, you've never heard about icing a bro?
I've never iced a bro, nor have I been iced by my bros, but now I'm terrified to know what it is.
Yeah, you should look it up. It's this thing that like frat boy like douchebags do where they like make another one drink a Smirnoff Ice, but it's like this weird gay thing where they have to do it like on one knee. It's bizarre, but it's a real thing that douchebags do.
You drink a Smirnoff Ice on one knee?
I don't really get what the get what the whole thing is. You'll have to look it up, but I've heard about it. But yeah, ice and a bro. That's what this movie made me think of.
That sounds maybe more boring than this movie, but
next time I see you, I'm gonna ice you, and
hope I know what it is by then, so that I can.
You'll have to chug a Smirnoff Vice in a slightly homoerotic way. You'll have to. You'll be obligated to.
Well, I mean, if I'm obligated, I guess I can't get out of it.
Yeah. That's how I felt about this movie.
Well, I'm gonna wrap this up so I can go grab myself a cool Smirnoff Ice.
Yeah, I'm gonna grab my cocaine.
Parker, you put on a Rockadile shirt, and when we come back, you can tell us all about 2019 after the fall of New York.
Sounds good.
Since the nuclear holocaust, 20 years have passed. The leader of the Yurok monarchy, the powerful Euro-Afro-Asian unity who pressed the fatal button, claims to have won the conflict. But planet Earth has been reduced to a garbage-strewn radioactive desert, inhabited by humans devoid of all hope for a future.
That thing back there was a cyborg, half man, half robot.
I don't have time to jaw with anyone who won't identify himself.
And we're back on Junk Food Dinner. Next up, we've got 2019 After the Fall of New York, which is an Italian-French science fiction nightmare from 1983. In this film, we have all kinds of weird science fiction-y post-apocalyptic stuff going on. Apparently, sometime in the past now, it would have been in 1999, Europe, Asia, and Africa got together to take out America, finally. The world is none the better afterwards, as everything is gone. New York especially is blown up. And we have small little pockets of mutated civilization surviving, and they're sort of eking out an existence, trying to get past the Yurax, who are the aforementioned European / Asian / Africans, who have apparently won, quote unquote, the war, and are now taking over the burnt rubble of New York slowly but steadily. They've got sort of a stranglehold on the place, and the American government has all but been dismantled and has retreated to their weird spaceships and cool moon bases in Alaska. But yeah, so the movie opens up with all kinds of cool warfare. The Yurax like to ride horses and burn people and hit them with maces in the streets of New York, which is a lot of fun. I mean, that's what I would do if I took over the world. I guess I would just get on a horse and wear like a grill on my face and attack people with maces.
It's good to have goals.
So that's what's going on in New York. Meanwhile, out in the Nevada desert, we have a guy who wishes he was Snake Plissken, and his name is Parsifal, because they decided to give him a really badass name, like Snake Plissken.
Right.
So Parsifal is doing like a B shoot for Death Race 2000 out in the desert, and he's having a lot of fun, and he's in this tournament where people get in cars and kill each other for fun. And of course he wins because he's our protagonist, and he gets a cool slave chick, and he gets a couple of licenses to kill, and he's sent on his way on his motorcycle to drive around in the desert and have some fun. Then the government, the Confederate of Pan America, which is our government now, kidnap this guy, take him to Alaska, and tell him in a script that would later be reused in Hell Comes to Frogtown that he has to go find the only fertile woman on Earth, bring her back to the government so that they can do experiments on her and bring humanity back from the brink of extinction. He reluctantly accepts his mission, and they team him up with a nerdy sort of an accountant-looking guy with a cool claw hand named Bronx, and a silent, large man with an eye patch that looks like a vagina named Ratchet. And they are sent into New York to find this woman. As soon as they get there, like in a matter of moments, they're captured by the Harlem Hunters, who's like this cool group. They're like a gang that wear like Mets jackets with spikes coming out of them and stuff, and they're pretty awesome. So so our heroes get captured immediately, and then the Yurax invade the Hunters' base and then kidnap again our protagonists, because our protagonists aren't very good at their jobs apparently. So they, Parsifal and his buddies, are in the base, and they concoct a fun way to escape. They take a lady hunter with them for some reason that I wasn't too clear on, and meet up with some midgets, and they meet up with some monkey men, and they proceed to try to enact their plan to get humanity back on the right path. And there's a lot of twists and turns and cool characters and explosions and horrible deaths and people getting their eyes gouged out because this is Italian and so on and such. So I mean, that's basically 2019 without giving too much away, and there's kind of a lot to give away. I guess more than normal, more than in Iced, I suppose. There's some twists and turns there. So I don't want to give anything away about robots or monkey men or anything like that. But so how do you guys like 2019? I've been talking it up for a while. I've been wanting to do this on the show for a long time, so hopefully me talking it up didn't ruin it for you.
No, this was actually one that I had wanted to see for a while too. So, and when you sent me the DVD a while ago, but I had waited to watch it, and I'm glad you finally picked it. I love, we talked about this when we did Rats, and, I love the Italian stuff, and this is super Italian. I thought it was great. I also thought it was crazy how many things it ripped off all at once, which is impressive to me. And, Yeah, I just thought it was fun. I liked the characters, and I liked the sets and all the post-apocalyptic. And I thought the sound was awesome. A lot of ridiculous laser noises and shit, which was fun. Also, I thought that there were a lot of similarities to Children of Men.
Right, yeah. trying to, you know, capture the last fertile woman and bring her back to safety. Yeah, that's definitely...
And the presence of that Picasso painting, you know, that was kind of a...
Oh, yeah.
A big thing. And then someone gets hit with a car door. that was another one. But yeah, I like this a lot, and I'm glad you picked it. So I thought it was fun.
Yeah, it was cool. It was interesting. Like Mark said, it did rip off a lot of movies, but there are movies that I liked a lot. As we kind of alluded to earlier, it did have a very Escape from New York feel, just the whole going into New York. And I even think there's one point where the guy says, like, you know, going in will be easy, getting out will be the hard part, and like that's almost directly ripped off from Escape from New York. And the lead guy is a very kind of Snake Plissken kind of character, just this badass guy that doesn't take shit from anyone. And he reminded me a lot, like, just in looks, of Sawyer from Lost. I don't know if I was...
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, and another movie that it kind of ripped off in some ways was The Warriors, just how there was all these different gangs, like, once they got into New York, kind of like you mentioned, the Harlem gang, and then there was, like, the gang of midgets, there was, like, a bum gang, there was, you know, that circus gang that had, like, the ape guys in it and stuff. So it was cool, like, how they came across all these various gangs and how they each had their own kind of unique characteristics and stuff. So that was a lot of fun. But, you know, like a lot of these Italian movies, these low budget post-apocalyptic things, the dubbing is kind of like a mishmash of like fairly good dubbing and fairly terrible dubbing, because I think, you know, it was they had two sets of actors, you know, like American actors and Italian actors, so some of the people they're, you know, dialogue matches up with perfectly, and some of them it's just like, you know, totally off. So that gets kind of distracting. But if you're used to that kind of stuff with, you know, this Italian fare, then, you know, it probably won't be that big of a deal.
True. I mean, even, yeah, there's really no shortage of movies that this movie rips off. Even Rats, you know, the rats play a big part in devouring some of these people. So,
right.
When I was gone, I listened to your Rats episode, and you guys were fighting a lot about whether or not the rats got killed or not, and I'm fairly certain that the rats were just being slaughtered in this movie.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they were just getting like stabbed left and right. I meant to mention how I was unaffected by that this time too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, in addition to rats being slaughtered for our entertainment in this movie, they kill a lot of real midgets later on in the film, which I assume that midgets would be on your list, Mark, of species of animals.
I was going to say they're kind of the rats of the human kingdom, but I was I decided against saying that. So for all intents and purposes, I didn't say that.
Yeah.
But they are.
Yeah. Yeah, I also liked that there was a lot of crazy weaponry used in this movie. I liked the ratchet guy. He had like those two like ball bearings on a string that he would swing around and smack people in the head with. And
yeah, I wasn't really clear on how that worked, but it seemed to be extremely effective.
Yeah.
Yeah. He killed so many people with those things, but yeah, they're basically just Benoit balls with fishing line attached. They're pretty awesome. I mean, he killed so many people.
Well, yeah, it kind of makes sense. Yeah, because, I mean, you could use them for a lot of different things. You can smack somebody in the head with them. You can choke a guy out with them. Or you can throw them from across the room and trip a guy up.
You can kind of, like, rotate them in your hand while you meditate.
Right. And then stick them up your ass for easy storage.
Yeah, there's a scene that the first time I watched it, my friend Blake Sell, who came to the junk food dinner party, he bought this because he's a big Italian horror movie buff, and I watched it with him, and we just could not get over the one scene where one of Parsifal's crew members kind of sacrifices himself in the base, the Yurak base, so that Parsifal and his lady friend can escape. And the guy stops, like, they're running away, and the guy stops, and he's like, Parsifal's, hey, you know, what are you doing? Come on. And the guy's like, no, good luck, Parsifal. You got to do this. And then Parsifal doesn't give a knowing nod. He doesn't say thank you. He doesn't convince the guy to come. He just turns and rolls the fuck out. Like, he's unfazed by his friend sacrificing himself.
Yeah.
He was suffering silently, though, you could tell.
Yeah, I also loved in this movie that, you know, pretty much for the majority of this movie, they're running from, you know, being captured by these guys. And they're constantly being shot at, but, you know, not once does a single shot hit them, despite about, you know, they're getting shot at about 4,000 times per minute.
Yeah, Parsifal did get stabbed quite a few times, though.
Yeah, that's true, but it never seemed to really slow him down.
Yeah, well, he's a lot tougher than that kid from Iced who got stabbed in the shoulder and then just gave up. that's not for Parsifal. Yeah. Also, I like that the main midget that they hang out with,
yeah,
his
Shorty.
Name is Shorty.
Yeah.
Which I found bizarre.
He looks like midget Jack Black.
Yeah, he kind of did.
That's very true. But yeah, I thought it was funny that his name was Shorty, considering he's from an entire clan of midgets where he was a fairly average-sized dude. I don't know why they would have named him Shorty.
Yeah, that is bizarre.
That was the most important part of this movie, that his name was Shorty, I guess.
Yeah, there's been a lot of releases of this. You can find it fairly easily. It was on a post-apocalyptic triple feature that had this movie, 1990, The Bronx Warriors, and The New Barbarians from 1984, which are all kind of in the same vein. There was a previous DVD solo release of this movie that actually got recalled because I guess there were some libelous comments made during one of the interviews or commentary portions of it, so they had to pull it to not get sued. I don't know exactly the specifics of it, but I guess somebody talked shit about somebody else and they had to...
Yeah, I think somebody actually referred to midgets as the rats of humans. they had to get rid of that immediately.
But yeah, there's a brand new controversy-free release that you can pick up as well. That's the one that I watched. And it was actually, I don't know, for something that's been out so many times, the transfer was a little shitty. There was, like, at the very beginning of the movie, it was released by Media Blasters, and they usually do a pretty good job. But, like, at the beginning of the movie, there was some real bad, you know, damage to the print, obviously, that kind of made it jump a little bit at the beginning of the movie, which was kind of weird. But, you know, for the most part, it looked all right.
Yeah, I've got the triple pack with the other two post-apocalyptic movies, so...
Yeah, how are those?
I haven't seen those yet because I'm waiting to watch... Well, I think I've seen The New Barbarians before, but I'm not for sure. I watched a lot of weird post-apocalyptic stuff with Blake So when I lived with him. But but I'm holding off to get into those because we're going to be watching those on Junk Food Dinner in the future. So you guys get ready for some post-apocalyptic stuff.
Right.
I've seen clips of the Bronx Warriors, and it looks a lot like a post-apocalyptic New York movie, so can't really go wrong there.
Yeah, New York... in this movie looks awesome, I thought, with the miniatures. In the beginning, there's this cool scene where, you know, the credits play and there's an old mutated, radiated dude playing a trumpet. And there's all these cool miniatures of a destroyed New York. And I thought it looked really cool.
Yeah, I thought that was awesome. I mean, they look like miniatures, but I thought they did a good job with it. And I thought it was better than it could have been.
Yeah. I mean, this movie isn't perfect by any means, but if this is the kind of thing that you're into, it's definitely worth watching. I mean, if you're a fan of kind of that post-apocalyptic stuff and you don't mind some bad dubbing and some cheesy special effects, but lots of good gore and, you know, some cool set pieces, then I think this is definitely worth watching.
For sure.
Yeah, the set pieces are great. I mean, they're hanging out in Nevada, and then they're hanging out in destroyed New York, and they're going through tunnels, and they're going through caves, and they go to Alaska, and they're in cool moon bases. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on in this movie, which I like.
That you mention all these locations that they go to, and they're all, you know, across the United States, but I think all of this was filmed in Italy. So, it's interesting.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I thought it was funny that to film a scene that takes place in a nuclear war ravaged in New York, they probably just filmed it on some normal street in Italy or something.
Right. Yeah, one of the parts.
They did film on location on the moon. But I think everything else was in Italy.
Right.
Yeah. There's this guy who shows up part way through the movie who helps out Parsifal, and his name is Big Ape, and I fucking love Big Ape because he has this cool... Like, he runs this gang of ape men, some more apey than others,
Yeah, like some are like, lot more AB than others.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of bizarre. Some just have like full beards and then there's like full ape.
I guess, Parker, you or I guess, Kevin, you have a beard now, too. Any of us could be considered ape men.
Yeah, this is probably, like, if we were in this world, I would want to be in that gang above all the other gangs. So that would work out.
Yeah.
I'd like to be in the midget gang.
You could just dwarf it up, like, just, like, kneel on your shoes.
Right. Or I'd like to be in the Harlem gang, but I don't think they would have me.
They were a pretty tough crew.
Yeah.
I think you would need, like, a New York Knicks jacket or something.
Yeah. Starter cap.
Yeah, I love Big Ape, and I love his sword that he can throw at people and then decapitate like 8 or 9 guys all at the same time.
Right.
Like, I thought that shit was awesome. Like, that's the coolest way to get away in your station wagon is by throwing a sword and decapitating a small army.
Yeah, now it's funny you talked about, like, you know, the New York Mets jackets and stuff. And it's cool to see that stuff because it is like fairly 80s fashion and it would seem dated, but they have a cool, you know, in post-apocalyptic movies, they kind of have a way around that because, you know, culture would in essence stop in the 80s when this movie, you know, took place. So it would make sense that everyone would still be dressed like, you know, in the year 2019 as if it were 1989. So,
yeah, well, it's, yeah, you mentioned that, and I was watching this and thinking, like, all right, I'm moving to New York. I have roughly 8 years before this happens. Okay, that's fine. But, that, you know, in the beginning, they say it's been 20 years, so this actually happened in 1999.
Right.
So we narrowly avoided this, I think.
Yeah. If we're lucky, who knows, maybe we'll still get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably a good thing that this didn't happen, because then in the real world, when that guy would be playing the trumpet against the skyline of destroyed New York, he would probably be playing like a Smash Mouth song or an NSYNC song.
Yeah.
Chuck Mangione.
Real Big Fish.
Oh my God. Yeah, so that's 2019 After the Fall of New York in a nutshell. I suggest everybody watch it because I think it's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And there's cool twists. There's M. Night Shyamalan like twists near the end. And yeah. But yeah, so that's the movie. We're going to take a break. And then we will be back, and we will be pleasured by Birdemic, Shock and Terror. It's a long time. Don't you owe me some money? I think somebody's calling. I gotta go. Just hanging out with my family, having ourselves a party.
Kitchen, and everybody's wishing that she's fixing their favorite dish. Just hanging out with my family, having ourselves a party. Just hanging out with my family, having ourselves a party.
So now you got a big payday with a big stock option, huh?
Yeah, I earned it. All those big deals I did with NCT. Woo-hoo! And millions of dollars of revenues and sales.
Well, you've done a great job, Rod.
Meet Rod.
Hi.
The young software salesman on his way to achieving his Silicon Valley dream.
Thinking about opening up a green tech company.
Really?
Meet Natalie, a beautiful young fashion model driven by
passion.
I remember you now. You were my English class.
I was.
Yeah.
So how come you never made a pass at me in school?
Throw true love into the equation, and anything is possible.
I was wondering if we can keep in contact.
Sure.
How big was the sale?
$1 million.
In other news today, the population of polar bears is declining rapidly.
Hi, my name is Jerry Owens. I'm from Solar Power Accessories.
This morning, flocks of seagulls and crows were found dead in downtown San Jose and along Highway 101.
Hey, I thought I told you to stand back. These birds are contaminated.
The crows and seagulls also caused an accident on Highway 101. Authorities are investigating the cause of their death.
Come on, let's get out of here.
human species is a dangerous, menacing, and terrifying animal.
This is Burnt.
Birds do something like that. Why would they just attack?
I don't know.
All right, welcome back to Junk Food Dinner, episode 18. The final movie we're going to take a look at this week is Birdemic, Shock and Terror from 2008. This movie has become fairly infamous in the last year or so, thanks to its super low budget, super cheesy special effects, and just all-around shittiness that has made it a cult favorite for midnight moviegoers around the country who have been lucky enough to get a chance to see it. The movie was done by a Vietnamese immigrant by the name of James Nguyen. He made this movie with his own money of $10,000 and 5 years of his own time, shooting it on weekends and whenever he could find time. He was a software guy in the Silicon Valley, and, you know, just wanted to make a movie and wanted to make a big budget romantic thriller, as he calls it. So the end result is an obvious labor of love, but, you know, is very, very, very low budget. I mean, just slightly better than, you know, a backyard movie that you would make with your friends. The production quality is, you know, basically bottom of the barrel. The special effects are laughable at best. But the earnestness and honesty of the movie is, I think, what makes this a movie that people love to go see. There have been a few kind of recent phenomenons like this. We had talked about earlier a movie called The Room, which is bringing out crowds by the hundreds to see just to basically make fun of. And this is kind of going in that same line. It's been released in small runs throughout the country, usually in small art house theaters. And like I said, a lot of people come to midnight showings to watch it and kind of rip on it and just kind of have a good time watching it. But the story of Birdemic revolves around a guy named Rod, much like director James Nguyen is a guy in Silicon Valley making it with the software firm and whatnot. He's on the verge of a big deal that's going to net him literally millions of dollars. He spends a lot of time walking around. You know, there's a lot of long shots of him, like, walking from his car into a coffee house. in the coffee house, he meets a young Natalie, played by the lovely Whitney Moore. They soon develop a relationship and, you know, start seeing each other. Also, Rod makes the big deal at work, which makes all of his bosses happy, which leads to about, you know, 20 minutes of clapping in the office. And just when things are going so great, he's finally, you know, getting it on with Natalie and, you know, making them dollars. Oh, the shit hits the fan as the birds start to attack. Eagles and vultures have gone nuts. We don't really know why, but we know it has something to do with global warming. And, yeah, they start attacking, much like in the style of the 1963 Alfred Hitchcock movie The Birds. Only this time, they are made by the lamest, like, computer-generated effects. The birds literally just float in midair, flapping their wings. It looks so laughable, but it's so great at the same time. So Rod and Natalie meet up with these dudes, Susan and Tony, I think, and try to escape this Birdemic. They also find a group of two kids that have been orphaned by these bird attacks. They pick them up along the way, and they kind of go along trying to avoid this Birdemic. So that's about it. Mark and I were actually fortunate enough to see this on the big screen. And yeah, if you get a chance to see it in the theater, that's really the optimal way to see it, with preferably with a big group of people, you know, all going nuts and yelling at the movie and having a good time. But, you know, it's one of those movies that's so bad it's good, and, you know, a lot of people throw that around. But, you know, this one, like I said, it's not something that was done intentionally. It wasn't just made to be a bad movie. I think it was honestly made to be a good movie, and I think that's what makes it so funny, is that it was an honest attempt at a serious action movie. So, yeah, what did you guys think of this?
This movie is wild to me.
Yeah.
Like, I think one of the very first episodes we did of the show, Mark mentioned this movie. I never heard of it, and I downloaded it way early in the beginning of doing this, hoping that somebody would pick it and waiting to watch it for somebody to pick it, and now that day has come. And I just, you know, and people have been talking it up. Like, I've read things on the internet, people calling this the worst movie ever made. You guys have been pretty excited about saying that it's one of the worst movies ever made. And I was like, well, whatever. You know, I've seen Troll 2, and I've seen House of the Dead, and I've seen The Happening. Nothing can be worse than these movies. And those movies are like Citizen Kane compared to this piece of shit. This is the... It boggles the mind. Like, watching it, I was like, man, this guy must have been joking. Like, this must be some kind of fucking joke. But it's real. It's so real. And I mean, my mind is boggled that somebody could have made this and felt good about it. Felt good about showing it to other people.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, just... This... Like you said, this the term "so bad it's good" gets tossed around a lot, but I really think that this is like the pinnacle of "so bad it's good." This is, without a doubt, like the worst, best movie I've ever seen. And when we went to the theater, it was actually the second time I saw it in the theater, and it was a blast. And I will probably go if it comes back again while I'm still here. I'm gonna go see it again. It's everything about this. It's just so fantastic, from the digital silence to Damian Carter's magnificent performance of just hanging out parenthetically with my family, to you know, Whitney Moore's mom's excessively long thumbs up, like, just there's no point in this movie that something hilarious isn't happening.
Right.
And the best part is that it's completely genuine.
Right.
You know, there's no sense that there's this like tongue in cheek, like, oh, you know, this is a joke, you know, this is joke bad. Like, this is bad, and that it's the best bad possible because it's not supposed to be.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I want to talk about is, you know, the performances in this movie are fairly wooden and fairly bad. Obviously, you know, with a $10,000 budget, these were not professional actors. These were just young upstarts that were trying to get their foot in the door. And, you know, I think even James Wynn in interviews has said, you know, he posted stuff online looking for actors, and these were basically people that were just willing to work for free. So that definitely shows through. But also, like you had mentioned, that one thing that makes the performances even more wooden is the editing in this movie is so piss poor. Like you mentioned, every time the scene cuts to a different, you know, angle, there's that like half a second of digital silence, and then the sound comes in every cut, and it's just like so jarring, and it's obviously just very amateurishly edited by a guy named Kim Chow. And shame on you, sir, for putting your name in the credits.
Yeah, and I mentioned this, I think, maybe the first time we talked about it, but I had heard a few things, and like I watched the trailer and stuff, but I was mainly just going to go. And when we went into the theater and sat down and like the movie started, you know, it's like easily 7 minutes of just driving. But right.
Barry Manos, the Hands of Fate.
Yeah, yeah. The theme starts, and then it ends. And then, like, 10 seconds later, it just starts again. Like, they just looped it. And from right. then on, I was like, oh, this is going to be something special. And it really, I mean, it didn't disappoint. So, and I don't know if I told you guys this, but Whitney Moore and I are engaged.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, it's pretty big news. I'm marrying her for her Birdemic money, though.
Right. All 50 bucks that she made.
Yeah.
Well, those 50 bucks are going to double because Birdemic 2, The Resurrection, is said to come out next year, apparently.
Yes, in 3D.
Yeah, so you can,
is that right?
You can see those Super Nintendo quality graphics burst forth from the screen and hover in front of your face as birds do.
Now, Mark and I had kind of talked about this, but I think it'll be impossible to really capture the, you know, quote unquote magic that made this movie like so enjoyable for audiences with a sequel, because I think now they're just going to be a little too self-aware, especially since they're getting all this buzz and people are going to see it and dubbing it as like the best worst movie. I don't know if they're actually going to be able to translate that into a sequel without, you know, like I said, really being aware of the fact that they're acting bad and the editing's bad. And if they try to like keep that, then it's like intentional, or if they try to up it, you know, it just, I don't think they could capture what they had with this first movie with a sequel. So
also this is, it's set to come out next year. And you know, this was lovingly crafted over 5 years. So
right.
If they're going to rush, if they're going to rush something like that into production, it's just not going to come off the same.
Right. But yeah, I mean, this movie has gotten a lot of, you know, kind of attention since it started hitting the circuit. I guess originally, director James Wynn went to the Sundance Film Festival in 2009 and really just like to freelance promote his movie, just handing out flyers. He drove around in a van with that was adorned with stuffed birds and a sign that said, you know, birdemic.com. And why did the eagles and vultures attacked? Past tense.
Yes. yeah, and then you could go in and sit in the van and watch the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was because he sent it to Sundance and it got rejected. So he went anyway and promoted it himself.
Right.
I read that the van he drove around in, it didn't even say birdemic.com. It said biddemic.com. That he misspelled the name.
Yeah, it's so wonderful. And one of my favorite parts about, you know, the whole mythology of Birdemic is that the director is just like so thrilled that people are into this movie that I think he's like completely oblivious to the fact that it's not because it's this, you know, Hitchcockian masterpiece that he thinks it is.
Right.
But I think that even speaks more to, you know, how genuine it is that he's just like, yeah, people love it. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Also the, this movie kind of got a lot of help promotion-wise from Tim and Eric, who do Tim and Eric's awesome show, Good Job or Great Job or whatever, on Adult Swim. I guess they were early fans of this movie. They actually had a premiere of it where they hosted, and they actually did an episode called Crows, which was an homage to this movie. So that's if you have seen this movie and you want some additional material, check out the Crows episode of Tim and Eric. Pretty awesome.
Severin, who we've talked about in the past, they're putting out the re-release of Motor Psycho and stuff. They're the ones who picked this up and they're touring it around and they're going to put it out on you know, DVD and Blu-ray and so, and they're really giving it, you know, the royal treatment, which I think is totally awesome. So, you know, kudos to them. They really put out a lot of really great stuff. And Kevin, I meant to tell you, they have Motor Psycho shirts now.
Oh, nice. I'll have to check that out. But yeah, I mean, if you love just like cheesy cinema and you can really get a good laugh out of it and like just laugh at the low production qualities. I mean, they CGI stuff in here that has no need to be CGI. Like they find a dead bird on the beach and instead of just having like a stuffed bird that would have cost all of $50, they CGI it and it looks, you know, expectedly like crap. When they fire their guns, it's CGI'd. Instead of, you know, again, spending the 80 cents for blank bullets, they just CGI the gunfire in, and it looks hilariously awful. And, you know, they're shooting guns at these just hovering birds. I mean, the special effects, I think, the wooden acting, the poor editing, the low budget aside, I think the CGI special effects are the real, you know, selling point of this movie. Because, I mean, it's ridiculous on every aspect, but that is just so over the top.
It's atrocious.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie, actually, and one of the movies that we saw before, Munchies, it was about these little monsters, and they were basically the toys, or the props themselves were basically just toys that people from off screen threw at the actors. And that would have worked brilliantly in this movie rather than these horrible CGI messes. Just these fake birds being thrown from off screen. Because that's what birds do. Yeah. They get flown, they travel through the air. And I was just so upset that nobody thought to do that at all. There's not one real bird, or not one physical manifestation of something resembling a bird in the entire
Okay, that's not necessarily true, because in multiple shots, there are birds just hanging out, just like flying around, and nobody like pays any mind to them.
Yeah, real birds.
Yeah, real birds apparently pose no threat. It's just these very specific, horrible CGI birds.
Yeah, there's a scene where they pull off on the side of the road, and they're being attacked by birds and everything, and obviously this film sucked real bad, so they couldn't close the road off for the film. So people are just driving by on the way to the beach without a care in the world.
Normal, everyday stuff.
Yeah, I have to imagine that half the budget for this movie was raised by their in-movie advertising for ImaginePeace.com, which they have just awkwardly placed posters and T-shirts with that on there. And that's actually, I think, a website that's owned by Yoko Ono, who, since this director is Vietnamese, I don't know, may have some connection to in some way. But yeah, I just thought that was really weird.
Seems racist somehow.
Yeah, but logical also in some way.
Well, it is very racist because the one character in the movie who's wearing the Imagine Peace shirt is the Asian lady.
Right.
So it is racist.
Oh yeah, that's one of the other phenomenal musical pieces in this is just a total Imagine ripoff that they play over and over and over again.
Yeah, that scene where the Asian girl is wearing the Imagine Peace shirt, the scene before that where they have the Imagine Peace poster in her bedroom is that real awkward love scene where she's just like laying on top of the guy in a bikini, and
that was
really weird.
At best.
That poster is just so obvious. Like, it's not even a real poster with a design. It's just white with black letters that says ImaginePeace.com.
Right. Why would you hang that up in your bedroom?
Now, there's a lot of parts of this movie that I could say are my favorite, but, and I mentioned this before, my absolute favorite part is the scene where they go on their first date and they're at a bar and a man named Damien Carter is performing at this bar.
Oh, yeah. He
performs a song called Hanging Out With My Family, and they dance really awkwardly, and there's no band on stage. Okay. Nobody is hanging out with their family at any point in this, but it's great. And I really hope that Severin puts out a soundtrack and that's on there. And I also think maybe we should hire Damien Carter to do a junk food dinner theme.
Oh my God, that would be magic.
Yeah,
and then you get to witness Whitney Moore's whitest dance of the robot ever.
Oh, it's painful. It's just everything about this date is painful.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Some of my favorite parts of the movie. I have a big long list of things to make fun of. But the main guy, whatever the hell his name is,
he meets Rod.
He meets up with girl, and after, like, he's kind of like that guy from Time Changer who's like all like a pervert about Russell Carlyle's Bible. Because he's just sitting in this place staring at this girl for like 20 minutes. But he finally goes up to her and talks to her. And he's like, hey, you went to San Mateo High School, right? And she's like, yep. And he's like, oh, cool. So are you from around here? She goes to your fucking high school. Another part I cared for is he's at his job. And he's on the phone trying to sell something to somebody. And he says, hey, if you buy from us, I'll give you a 50% discount.
Oh, yeah, and, that was Kevin's favorite part, too.
Yeah, that cracked me the fuck up.
Yeah, he gives him a 50% discount on $1 million sale. So
right,
he just
threw away $1 million.
Just giving away hundreds of thousands.
I do that shit on Craigslist, though. I put stuff up for twice as much as I want, and then when someone expresses any kind of interest or even like disgust that I would charge so much, I would just, I mean, you know what, 50% off for you.
It's a good tactic.
Yeah, it works. I mean, I learned it from this movie, so.
I also liked Rod, who's obsessed with global warming and stuff. A solar panel guy comes out to his house to try to sell him some solar paneling. And Rod's like, okay, well, you know, maybe we can do this. Where are you going to put the solar panels? Where the fuck would he put the solar panels? They're going to go on the goddamn roof.
Right. Well, luckily, immediately after asking that, that guy goes out and points at his roof for you.
It's so good. Let's see, what else do I have on this list? I'm a regular Jerry Seinfeld with my list of jokes.
I'll tell you one of my favorite parts is when they meet that lovable hippie in the woods with the terrible fake wig.
Tony.
Yeah. Well, that guy was hilarious. But I like that they have to stop talking to him because a mountain lion showed up.
Yeah. I think I hear a mountain lion calling.
See ya.
Yeah, and I was at the mountains the other day, probably close to being these same mountains, actually. And the first thing, like, they tell you when you go to these mountains, you pay your $2 to get in or whatever. And they're like, hey, if you see a mountain lion, don't run. And the first thing they do when that guy mentions the mountain lion is they run away.
Yeah.
These people, it would have been such a cool ending if these people would have been mauled to death by a mountain. Ironic.
Yeah, make you wonder who the real predators were.
Right. It's not the birds I'm worried about, it's man.
And mountain lions.
Yeah, we get a strong dose of finding out that man is the real predator in the film.
Yeah, they really hammer that home. I also like when they come out of their like awkward-ass double date from the movie theater, and Rod says, that was a good movie, An Inconvenient Truth.
Yeah, this movie's got a real real global warming agenda, which is kind of odd. Yeah.
Global warms the heart, too.
Half of the dialogue is just about global warming. In fact, it's very much like The Time Changer, where you just got this flimsy little plot, which is an excuse for people to go on long monologues about their dogmatic belief system.
Right.
Also, I liked when they fight the birds with coat hangers, or yeah, wire coat hangers.
Right.
It reminded me of that show Nick Arcade, where this guy like had to paw at something on a blue screen and hope you touched it.
Yeah, this whole movie reminded me.
The effects on that were better, I think.
Yeah,
I think the special effects in this movie
on Nick Arcade was light years ahead of Birdemic.
I also thought it was fun that they grabbed wire hangers to fight the birds because they are, after all, birds and not fetuses.
Right.
Fetuses. Fetuses. Yeah. And then also, near the end, they pay $100 a gallon for gas. And then and the guy's all, this is a ripoff, $100 a gallon for gas. And they peel out while pumping the gas because the birds show up. And then later on, Rod just casually mentions that he has a spare tank of gas in the back.
Right.
So I don't know why they would have spent that money on that gas. And the whole movie, like, they're driving for hours and hours and hours, it seems. Like, they stop to eat, like, five times. They stop for gas, like, five times. They're just hanging out on this highway. But the guy mentions, like, they start out in the city of Half Moon Bay, which I've been to. It's a very nice city. And the guy mentions, Rod mentions, that he lives in San Jose. It's not even an hour away. So I don't know where the fuck they were driving this entire movie. They live right. An hour away. It's just so ridiculous. Like, that not one time do they mention their plan of where they're going to go or what they're going to do or what's happening. Like, even in Night of the Living Dead, they turned on the radio to hear that they were dead and all messed up. You get nothing like this. No plot at all. No semblance.
Well, yeah, and then, you know what? I'm gonna spoil this movie since we've pretty much talked about every scene. The birds just stop attacking.
Right.
That's it. Like, that's the conflict resolution, is the birds just leave. And they just fly away, and then they wave at them while they leave, and that's it.
Yeah, and by leave, they just hover in place in the sky for about 10 minutes.
Over the ocean for 10 minutes, and then the credits finally happen.
Right. Yeah, I like in that scene, because they're on the beach, because they're so hungry that they have to fry up some seaweed.
Oh, no, they have to boil a fish.
Oh, yeah,
they boil a whole fish with some seaweed.
They're so hungry. It hasn't even been a day that they've been driving, and they're an hour from home. How hungry do you have to be? And they've been eating candy bars all day. And they had a nice picnic earlier, too.
Yeah, sandwiches from the gas station. Yeah, the world really went to shit quickly in this movie. Like, there was no time for people to react, apparently.
Yeah. Just no thought at all went into anything at all in this movie, it seems.
Yeah, which is astonishing since they had at least 5 years to, like, hammer out the details.
Yeah, not one time in 5 years did somebody go, hey, where the fuck are these people driving to? Where are they going to go?
I think my favorite Bill Perkins-esque character, which is, you know, what we refer to, somebody that has a small but insignificant role in the movie, but clearly steals the show. For me, in this movie, that would have to go to the kid on the double-decker bus in the Eazy-E t-shirt.
Yeah. I like how the Marine guy dooms those people. Like, he goes on this bus to try to save them, and they're all, no, don't save me, bro, don't save me. And he literally pulls them off the bus at gunpoint, and then as soon as they're off the bus, they get murdered.
Right. Yeah, they get thrown up on.
Yeah. By the birds, yeah.
By the birds, and then they are dissolved or something. I don't know. I think we've given away every detail of this movie. So.
But nevertheless, it won't be any less fun for you to see. So yeah, if you get a chance, you definitely have got to. If it comes to a theater near you, which, you know, it's like I said, it's been making its run around small theaters, you definitely got to go check this out. But it is getting, like you said, a DVD release from Severin sometime, hopefully very soon, so everyone can enjoy the absolute bonkers shittiness / awesomeness that is Birdemic Shock and Terror.
Yeah. Also, I like that everything is caused by the bird flu virus, which
right.
is not a thing.
Yeah.
Birds don't get bird flu. Like, when humans have the flu, they have the rhino flu. Birds don't get bird flu. It's just a name. And they didn't think about that at all. They didn't research anything.
All right, well, I think that's going to wrap up Birdemic Shock and Terror for us. We are going to take a small break, and you'll hear some excellent bongos, and we'll come back and wrap things up. So stick around. All right, well, that just about wraps up episode number 18 of Junk Food Dinner. I think 18 episodes in. Man, if every podcast was a year, our podcast would be old enough to vote and smoke cigarettes now. So.
And pose naked on the internet.
Yeah, so look forward to those Junk Food Dinner pictures coming soon.
I was going to tell you guys, in celebration, I did this whole podcast naked.
Nice.
Yeah.
I could feel it.
You could feel my nakedness.
I could feel your nudeness.
Yeah, think about me chewing those gumballs. Totally.
Awesome. Love it. But yeah, we'd like to thank you for listening. Make sure you keep your eyes on junkfooddinner.com. That's where you can find all the latest goings-ons in the world of Junk Food Dinner. There you can also befriend us on Facebook if you do that kind of thing, or follow us on Twitter. You can also hook up with us on Podcast Alley and iTunes. You can subscribe to us that way and have the podcast delivered every week directly to your computer or mobile device, and you can never be without your junk food dinner. Also, if you get a chance, leave us a comment on iTunes or Podcast Alley. That's a really good way to help spread the word about the show. Also, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so via Facebook, or you can send us an email at jfdpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions for movies that you'd like to see us watch on the show, or if you'd like to see us do a special theme show dedicated to one of your favorite cult film themes, we would be happy to hear from you and take that into consideration. Next week, we're going to be looking at the classic battle, evil versus evil, when we take a look at Freddy versus Jason. Then we have the exploitation car murdering classic Death Race 2000, starring Sylvester Stallone and David Carradine and Mary Warnoff. And then we will be taking a look at The Willies, which is a fan recommendation. So dreams really do come true on Junk Food Dinner. So make sure you listen next week for all that and a whole lot more. So yeah, until next week, this is Kevin Moss, Mark Fredo, and Parker Bowman saying adios, everybody. We will see you next week. and we love you so much.
When are you gonna grow up, man? Chicks love cars. If you want to get into their pants, you better have a nice hot Ferrari.
She's my hot Ferrari. Besides, I love my Mustang, which is a plug-in hybrid. It gets 100 mpg.